Yes. Don't you see? Don't you see how clear it all is? Not only can you see the future, you can...
I can change it.
You can change it, exactly.
Welcome to this review of The Dead Zone, part of the 3 Men in a Retrospective podcast, Stephen King Retrospective Series.
My God, what a glorious day!
Keep periodically coming back to percolatedmedia.net as Garrett.
Is that who I think it is?
His Majesty.
Matt.
The wolf is loose.
And Adam.
But I don't really need any research or documentation to see that this thing is sucking the life right out of you.
Continue going through the best-selling author's cinematic adaptations in publication order. So try to avoid the ice, percolated media listeners.
The ice is gonna break!
The Dead Zone retrospective begins now.
The missiles are flying.
The Dead Zone. Released October 21st, 1983. Budget on this was $7.1 million. Box office, $20.8 million. And this is directed by David Cronenberg. Matt, it has taken us 10 plus years, but we have finally gotten to a film by David Cronenberg.
Yeah, I wish I could be happier, but this is the Faustian bargain I had to make in order to get him on the schedule in some capacity.
Yes, after going through Night Shift, going through The Stand, a book that I said on those podcasts, it's looked at by a lot of people as being their favorite Stephen King book, but it wasn't mine. We have finally gotten to The Dead Zone, a book that I didn't get to till much later. A couple years ago, me and Jen took a trip to go see my mom in Colorado, and I took the book with me, read it on the plane, read it over there, read it on the plane on the way home, and I think I spent about an hour reading it at home before I finally finished it. I really enjoyed going through that book. Although this movie was a big part of my childhood. I watched it on a Sunday night movie special. So I watched it edited. I watched it with my father and my mom, and I taped it off TV, and it was a big part of my childhood. And of course, it's played on HBO a lot too. Adam, how'd you first get introduced to The Dead Zone?
I'd heard about it. I think I've seen this poster, a classic, really cool looking poster, a million times. I've seen the box art on videos and DVDs. Surprise to everybody at Percolated Media Airwaves, I've not seen this movie. Stunning, I know. But I knew that it eventually spawned a TV series that ran a couple seasons that was, from what I understand, pretty well regarded. Never saw it, don't know anything about it. But I just know that this was one of the adaptations people go, that one's pretty good. And that's about my knowledge completely. I didn't even know this was Cronenberg till I sat down to watch this.
Wow. Yeah, that TV series actually didn't run a couple seasons. It ran 6 seasons. And I binge watched it for this podcast, and I'll get to my feelings on that after we're done discussing the movie. Matt, you are a noted David Cronenberg fan. Was this one of the ones you had seen when you were going through his oeuvre the first time?
No. My introduction to this property was the Treehouse of Horror episode where they spoof it, and it's called The Ned Zone, where Flanders gets hit over the head with a bowling ball that Homer throws into his yard, and he has the touch telepathy thing, and it ends with Flanders having to shoot Homer to stop a nuclear apocalypse, but he shoots him, and his tongue hits the button, so it still happens. It's actually one of the funnier segments they did during that stretch. As far as Cronenberg goes, I waited to watch this because I thought this was him, quote-unquote, selling out, because it's kind of a, especially this time, easily the most commercial film he had done. And I still think you could argue that to this day, because while The Fly has more mainstream recognition as far as a name and the poster and the tagline, you kind of need a strong constitution and tolerance for gross out in order to get through it. This doesn't necessarily have that hurdle. So I think this would be his most, if you were asking me to pick a movie to start with, I would probably recommend this as an entry point.
There are definitely Cronenberg touches here, which I'll get into when we discuss the film. But you're right about one thing. This is his most commercial film because He was burnt out after doing Videodrome. Every single movie he had done up to that point, he had written and directed. And Videodrome apparently was a battle with the studios. It was a big studio film, and it didn't do so well. And he felt burnt out. And when he was looking for his next project, Deborah Hill was attached to this, and she asked to bring him on board after the other director had pretty much bowed out. So this is his biggest commercial film, but I think he saw this as a break. I think he was like, look, I haven't written this movie. I have nothing really to do with this except direct it. Let's attack it. So yeah, you are right. He did kind of sell out. As far as the making of this, before I get to that, the Dead Zone book. Now, we have discussed that up to now, we had Carrie, we had Salem's Lot, we had The Shining, and we had Night Shift, and of course, The Stand, which we just got through discussing. This was his first number one bestseller. This was the book that really cemented King as, okay, he can finally quit his day job and actually become a full-time writer. And it really took off from here. This book was the last book he released in the 70s. It came out in 1979. I think it's a very big encapsulation of the 70s if you read that book. A lot of things that he's dreading that are coming up in the 80s. And he didn't really look back on the 70s too fondly as far as this book goes. It's a big reflection of him. I think it's a very, next to The Shining, I think up to this point, it's his most autobiographical. I see a lot of King in the character of Johnny Smith. Matt, had you read this book?
It's sitting on my shelf, and I still have not gotten around to it.
I would recommend checking it out. Like I said, I didn't get to it till much later. The films we're discussing in this set of podcasts, Matt put together this set with Conclude the Stand, this, Firestarter, Cujo, and The Running Man. Adam, I'm pretty sure in high school I had at least one of those in my arm at each breaking moment.
I think that's a pretty fair assessment. Probably one under your arm, one in the bag, and one in a locker, just in case.
The Dead Zone pretty much encapsulated King's feelings on the 70s, and we'll talk about that as we get into the movie itself. And it was very well regarded, and this was picked up by Lorimor Films, but they had gone bankrupt before it actually went for production. Another director was attached to it named Stanley Dolan. At that point, it was scooped up by Dino De Laurentiis. And this is Dino De Laurentiis' first Stephen King adaptation production. We have discussed De Laurentiis already. We did Sometimes They Come Back, when we did Maximum Overdrive, when we did a lot of that Night Shift stuff. That was all Dino. And Matt, this was Dino's first production with Stephen King.
Yeah, and what a match made in creative heaven. The Stanley Donen thing blows my mind because he made Singing in the Rain.
I know.
And there's nothing in that movie that would lead you to believe he's the guy to do a Stephen King movie, especially this one of all of them.
So the first writer of this was a guy that, my God, I think if we get to The Lost Boys, we'll get to his entire filmography. Jeffrey Boehm was attached to write the first draft of this. He wrote it and he turned it in, and De Laurentiis did not like it. He sent it to King to do a draft of it. King did a draft of it, and according to some people, Dino was the one who rejected that script, but according to Cronenberg, he himself rejected it for being, quote, too brutal, which, okay. If Cronenberg's calling something too brutal, there must be something wrong there. They went back to Jeffrey Boehm, and they went to this Russian writer whose name I'm not even going to try to pronounce. And what ended up happening was, once Deborah Hill hired Cronenberg for the film, he, Hill, and Jeffrey Boehm got shacked up in a hotel, and they hashed out this entire film in about a weekend. So the script, as always, went through a ton of hands before it went in front of cameras. Now, have you guys heard about the other choices that were here for Johnny Smith?
I don't know the actors, but we should also mention that one of the people who was behind this is Deborah Hill.
I did say that. I said Deborah Hill.
Did you?
Yeah, I did.
I had my Dead Zone, apparently. and Cronenberg initially rejected the directing offer. It was his meeting with Deborah Hill that changed his mind. Yeah.
So the other choices for this. David Cronenberg's choice for Johnny Smith was the guy who would eventually play Frank Dodd, the assistant to the sheriff who gets revealed as a serial killer. That was his choice. King's choice, and Adam, you're going to love this. Bill Murray was Stephen King's choice for Johnny Smith. I don't think it got past the proposal stage. Here's the film we have. It was released in 1983, and I believe this had come out about 2 months after Cujo. Despite it being this part of the schedule, it's because the book had come out first. But 1983 was a big year because you had this, you had Cujo, and you had Christine all in the same year. And this was the big beginning of the Stephen King essence, I guess you could say.
But we're also still seeing the trend of getting directors with very distinctive styles to do adaptations, because we've had De Palma, we've had Tobe Hooper, we've had Kubrick. And Cronenberg is very much of the Kubrick mold, where he's got a very distinctive style. The only other thing I wanted to mention was he very recently finally put out a Blu-ray for this, which I was clamoring for years. And a lot of the stuff that's on there is worth checking out.
Yeah.
As far as the features, and they did a great job on the print restoration. The other thing I did want to mention was this movie did pretty well as far as finances go, considering what it was made for. But is it fair to say that kind of, when people mention Cronenberg, people often forget he did this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just because it's sandwiched in between Videodrome and The Fly.
Definitely. And it was not his film per se. And I think that's what he kind of craved after the Videodrome hell that he went through. So we open up, we get a picture of a house and very Norman Rockwell-esque. And some opening credits done to the music of another gentleman we've talked a lot about this year, Michael Kamen. And you know what? I love the score to this film. I think it's a beautiful score. I think it is one of his best. I was really digging finding pieces to attach to the credits of this, because this score really enhances the mood of this film.
Yeah, I think the score is very, very fitting. It doesn't overtake it. It's not distract. It's ridiculously complimentary.
And I love how these credits, the credits go by. We're seeing pictures. And Matt, we talked about this when we reviewed The Holdovers a couple years ago. But you look at the paintings this portrays, and you look at the way the film opens, the way the film is filmed. This thing makes you cold, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, that mirrors the actors. They were shooting in sub-zero weather. Like, it was really cold because they were shooting up in Toronto. I'm pretty sure they were shooting in Canada. It's a Cronenberg movie.
Yeah, so they were in Canada.
You can legitimately see the actors look uncomfortable in certain parts. And what also helps is the cinematographer on this movie, Mark Irwin, Cronenberg's DP for basically all of his early movies, like Fast Company, Scanners, this, Videodrome. So right away, I think the movie puts the notion aside that there's no Cronenberg in this, because he chose to bring in the guy who gave a lot of his early films that distinctive look. I don't want to call it grainy, but it's definitely got a washed out feel to it.
And I also love how these credits form the word dead zone. I just think that's awesome.
You know, though, because since we're going to move on from it real quick, it forms dead zone. And I can't believe how much I'm like, huh, interesting that I feel like I'm watching the opening credit sequence to Alien all over again. Except I feel like Alien actually came together quicker than this freaking title sequence for a movie that's only like an hour and 40 minutes. I could have went, made dinner, taken a shower, eaten it, came back, and these credits would not have been done yet.
Well, speaking of which, not that I'm looking at the book right now, but the book is of decent length, right?
It's over 400, yeah.
So I'm surprised that they condensed it into a less than two-hour movie, especially considering how long The Shining was. They turned Salem's Lot into a miniseries. Really, the only comp to this is Carrie, but Carrie's a much shorter book.
Well, that was a big problem that Jeffrey Boehm had when he went to tackle the script writing for it, is to him, the book was too episodic. And I'll get into it as we get into the film and I talk about the TV series, but there's a lot of things that happen here that come together at the end that would normally take about 2.5 hours in a movie made today or elongated 20-episode season of television. So to condense that down was a pretty good job by everybody involved. I think this thing is an hour and 40 minutes and it moves. I can't say any part of this, even the credits drag for me. This is about as efficient as you can do as far as condensing what this book is.
It's just funny that you mentioned Jeffrey Boehm complaining about the episodic feel, because I still feel remnants of that with how this movie is structured. But I also say that as someone who has not read the book.
Well, yeah, everything that happens in that book leads up to what he does at the end. So the episodic feel is building character, which I think good episodes do. So we hear a school bell ring as Walken is in full control of a class, talking Edgar Allan Poe. Which is kind of fitting that he's talking here about Edgar Allan Poe, and it's going to be brought up again as the movie goes on. How do we feel Christopher Walken does here?
I was trying to remember how often I've seen young Chris Walken, and it's not very often. So I'm immediately taken in. I think he kind of fits in the King world. He is that just northeastern, kind of plain Jane, simpleton, not simpleton, but just simple man. I'm laughing that while he's teaching this class, he mentions Sleepy Hollow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that just, I fell off my couch. And then it happens two more times in this film.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm forgotten that back before he's the Chris Walken that we're going to hear Matt do, I got to do it sometime during this podcast, because I'm not going to take away from it, that he was just this kind of quality actor. He's not stealing the show. He's not chewing up scenery. He's not walking through the scenes like Walken does. He's just there as a competent actor. And it took me a minute to kind of recalibrate what I've been used to the last, say, 30 years of Chris Walken.
Let's not forget, he was an Oscar winner at this point, too. He had one for Deer Hunter a few years before. Absolutely. So
he's kind of our parents' actor.
Yeah.
And then by the time you get to our age, he's almost the person who's asking for more cowbell. Yeah. And I was happy to see this Christopher Walken because it's not one that I'm used to.
Yeah, I think this is a terrific performance from Walken. And I think, especially not just with Children of the Corn, but you compare Walken's performance in this to the guy from Salem's Lot, any version. I think this is very appropriate and very quality acting from a guy who has sadly become just an internet meme. And when you go back and watch this or King of New York or Deer Hunter, you see just how great of an actor Christopher Walken is before, like I said, before he just became an internet meme. I think what also helps is that we finally have a king protagonist since Carrie that I think is eminently likable. That's been one of my hurdles with some of the movies we've talked about, is that I don't oftentimes feel like I have someone to root for. And more importantly, this character has an emotional connection with somebody that I actually find resonance with. So structurally, there's a lot more here in the Inception that I am latching onto from a story point, which I have not been able to say about most of the King properties we've covered.
You actually like him with that $3 haircut?
I mean, look, we saw Vito Akil with that bleach blonde hair.
Yeah, right.
This is a huge step up.
We're going to see a couple of Bond actors in this as we get further in. He runs into Brooke Adams, fresh from, well, at this point, yeah, she would have made Halloween 3 at this point. And, of course, the Invasion of the Body Snatchers remake, which I enjoy. And we talked about her when we did Sometimes They Come Back. She was in that as well. I don't know. I think she's a well-written character. I just don't like the casting. She smiles too damn much. Like, she's like Karen Allen in this movie, where every time you see her, I don't care if she's in duress, if she's crying over Johnny dying at the end. I don't care. She's just always smiling. I don't think she's very good here.
I think she's okay. I think they cast her purely based on her appearance. But she was a very embedded in the genre because of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. She'd do the stuff. She'd have a cameo in that right after this. And Days of Heaven kind of broke her into the mainstream, which is funny because it's funny. If you swap out Martin Sheen for Richard Gere, this would have been a Days of Heaven reunion. I think they're actually...
Oh, wow.
I could see Richard Gere playing that part in a little bit, but I think she's fine. You sound like the people who complain about Shelley Duvall in The Shining.
By the way, Richard Gere was looked at as being Johnny in this, which would have been funny that you made that connection.
Yeah, for the record, I can't see Bill Murray.
Neither can I. Brooke Adams was actually a recommendation by Christopher Walken. Him and her had just done a play a couple years before, and Cronenberg met with her and really liked what she brought, and so he cast her. And she thanks Walken like three times on those DVD extras, if you watch them. And by the way, she's living okay now. She's married to Tony Shalhoub.
She's fantastic. I don't know if she gives the best performance in this film, but I think she gives the most captivating. I think she actually captures the screen when she's on it. I think she's got a presence. It's funny. My note is, this is the Cronenberg version of Karen Allen, which is written on my page. So you beat me to it. And something about that smile, that face, those cheekbones and jaw, she's got a presence that I really like. You could have written her, especially with what happens here in a little bit. It'd be easy to not like her, but you do from the get-go. To Matt's point, there's not shitty characters yet. And usually we kind of start a lot of King's films with some shitty characters. It's nice to be going this way, but I think Brooke Adams is fantastic. I like her a lot. I could use more.
We cut to them on a roller coaster, seemingly by themselves, and
yeah, there's nobody else at this fair.
No one there. I thought this was a dream sequence at first. I was waiting for him to wake up.
Yeah, and we also see Johnny getting headaches here, so we know that something's not right with him. And the thing about this is, in the book, and they actually filmed this scene in the movie as well, but Cronenberg cut it. As a boy, he falls and he hits his head on some ice, and that's what kind of jiggles his brain a bit. And the book and movie pretty much define the dead zone differently. King defines it as just that area in the brain that is not used. That at this point, people were thinking that we use 10% of the brain, which... since then, we found out we do use all of our brain. And in this movie, it's defined as the moments in the visions that he gets where he can't see what happens. Cronenberg defines it much better, but at least here we know, even before the accident, something's not right.
Yes, and I'm glad because this also bucks the trend of King having to over-explain why supernatural components exist. So I appreciate that being thrown under the rug, especially because Cronenberg, body horror is not the same thing as supernatural. So that's not something he really delved into, so I'm glad he didn't feel like he had to do that because it was part of the original text.
Yeah, but I think King likes to, when he doesn't have an answer, likes to give it later on in interviews, and I think this is one of those times. So I think the film does a decent job.
He pulled a Ridley Scott saying, oh yeah, Deckard was a replicant all along.
Yeah, because from what I understand, he doesn't explain it in the book, but he's gone on to be like, oh, well, this is what the Dead Zone means.
He does. He explains in the book, the doctor says that
it's... Oh, the book does explain it.
Yeah, the doctor explains it in the book as being the part of the brain that he's not using. Which is why when the accident happens, the neurons went through and actually used that part, and that's why he has what he has in the movie.
Well, IMDb is stupid. Whoever put it down there made it seem like it was something he said later on.
No.
Okay. I was like, yes, I've seen Lucy. I enjoy that film. I get it.
Oh, God. Let's just be happy Johnny doesn't turn himself into a thumb drive at the end of this.
They get off the coaster and Johnny takes her home. He says that he's okay, though he doesn't want to go in. And she says that she's had a wonderful time, and he says that some things are just worth waiting for. Why? Why is he not going in here? He's got to be, what, in his late 20s at this point?
Yeah, this doesn't make sense. They're adults. There's not a reason for them to not do it. And he's even just kind of like shaking hands and leaving. You know? I mean, look, hey.
They should have called this movie The Friend Zone.
I've done the trick of, yes, just shake hands and make them chase you. But it doesn't make sense for what's going on here. They're capable adults. They're professionals.
Yeah.
She has her own house. Other than just to cause what happens next, it's kind of one of those, okay, I guess.
Yeah, and in the book, he's more than willing to go in, and she's the one who prevents it. So it's just, it's kind of weird that this is how
they end. I'm more than willing.
Yeah, I know you are. So she kisses him goodbye, saying that she's crazy about him, and then she tells him to drive carefully. Now, in the book, Johnny gets in a cab, and the cab is what gets in the accident. The fact that it's his own volition here, and he's the one driving, I don't know, kind of interesting decision there, saying that he's the one in control of this.
Yes, but all I'm thinking of is Misery. The same inciting incident, a car accident. I mean, look, it's kind of a scary harbinger of what happened to Stephen King himself.
Yes.
That he wrote two books where someone gets in a car accident and then he's almost killed by a car.
So the Volkswagen Bug that Johnny gets in takes off, and we see Johnny amongst a huge storm. He tries gazing at signs as a truck driver dozes off and dumps his milk trailer. How wholesome is that? It's a fucking milk truck.
Yeah. Were those even still a thing in the 80s?
Yeah, they were, but not much longer.
I feel like that would have been a lot more of a commonality if this was set in the 50s, which it very well could have been, especially with sort of the harbinger of nuclear war. That could have very well played in the 50s.
This, of course, means that Johnny's going to hit it, though not head on. It's through the side, and we see the driver open the door as we cut to Sarah walking into intensive care. Before I get to that, though, boy, not a very exciting accident.
You know, watching this slow-moving part of the trailer just kind of slide down the street, and he's just like, doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. I get it's rainy, but you could have quote the Raven, because I saw one sitting on top of the car while he was driving. It's all Western Union, because this is telegraphed from the second he gets in the car. It's just not very exciting. It's fine, but even for early Cronenberg, man, it gets you to the next scene.
Well, yeah, especially because Cronenberg has a thing for cars. He made Fast Company. He's always had sort of a interest in motorcycles and Formula One racing. I mean, look, this is the guy who made a movie where James Spader fucks his car.
Oh, me and Adam saw it in the movies.
In theaters.
Yep. We cut to Sarah walking into intensive care, begging Johnny not to die as they're supposed to be married. And then we cut to 5 years later as we see Johnny wake up as his doctor stands over him. Johnny says that his throat hurts, and the doctor gives him some water. He tells Johnny that he was in a terrible accident as Johnny holds out his hands and says that there aren't any bandages. I'll tell you what, boys. I know there's not anything... Well, there are a couple things that are horrific in this, which we'll get to, but just the fact of waking up 5 years later and all that life you've missed, that scares me.
Yeah, that part got to me. And I almost wish they would have dwelled on that a little bit. And I understand it's not the point of the story, but to me, that's the scary part. You see her, you go out for a drive, and it's 5 years later. I think there's a story to be told there that's more horrific than this one. But man, that I wasn't expecting that jump.
Doctor says that his parents are here, and they walk in as his mom calls it a miracle that the Lord has delivered him from his trance. Now, this is a character much bigger in the novel. In fact, I think this character also had Carrie, because it's pretty much the same exact person if you read that book. Kind of a religious zealot, but Matt, I mean, that's what King goes for, right? Especially in his early writing, going for these religious zealots.
Oh, very much so. I'm glad that was condensed dramatically in the adaptation, but I think the time period of being in a coma for 5 years, that just ties into my preference with King. I think he's at his best when there's a more reality-based not necessarily horror, but subject matter that is more stooped in reality. I think those tend to be the stories I identify with more. It feels truncated, not really expanded upon as much, but I also understand that this is a movie. If this was like Salem's Lot, I'm sure there would have been a lot more time of him like readjusting. But this is basically like when Captain America wakes up after being frozen in ice and then he goes to fight the Avengers 10 minutes later, what feels like 10 minutes later.
His mom also reveals that in the 5 years he's been gone, Sarah has married another man.
I wouldn't have led with that, by the way.
I know.
She's a buzzkill.
Right. We see a nurse bat Johnny down with a rag as Johnny wakes up and sees that her house is being burned down. He tells her that her daughter Amy is screaming as her house is burning. He also tells her that it's not too late to save her. This is very nicely shot, and I love how they put all this fire goo all over Christopher Walken as he's on this bed, but it really looks like sweat, and it adds to the drama of the scene, I think. I think this is very nicely shot. I love the fact that, I mean, there was no CGI. Walken is in this fucking bed. He's in with his head up, and his body is underneath the bed, but he's still here in this shot with this fire burning around him. It's just so harrowing, and man, this is a scary, scary thing.
All right, here we go. It is shot well. It is shot very well. Christopher Walken does a great job. I can't believe I'm watching a fucking Shining movie again. Because I did not know that's what I was going to get. And I am pissed off at this moment.
Oh, geez. I tell you what, this is funny. Matt, had you heard how Cronenberg got Walken to react like this?
No, humor me.
Cronenberg spent a lot of time with a gun on this set. Because it was Walken's request that he, every time he has one of these visions, that Cronenberg fire a 357 Magnum in the air, which is why every time he has a vision, he jolts, which I think added to every scene, and I think is pretty funny, actually. I just can't see Cronenberg with a gun roaming around the set.
I can, because he's the guy who on Scanner said, we need something to make this head explode. Let's just blast it with a 12-gauge.
Matt, we've heard Adam's thoughts. How do you feel about this scene?
Yeah, I'm sort of in the same boat as Adam, where can King do something besides psychics to explain visions? Scammon Crothers might as well be his physical therapist and have it be interconnected with how blatantly close it is. Either that or you have fucking Charles Xavier show up with a young Danny saying, we're putting the X-Men together. Although having Christopher Walken with a character who can't walk would actually be pretty funny.
Save the X-Men talk for next week when we get to Firestarter.
It's like the girl in the fire. I'm like, oh, is this Firestarter?
Yeah.
Because remember, the girl's name is Amy.
The girl's name in this is Amy, yeah. Not in Firestarter. It's Charlie in Firestarter. We cut to the nurse holding her daughter safely, so we know she got to her safely. And then we cut back to Johnny and his doctor, who says that Johnny needs to be in a wheelchair for a set of time. Not walking, as Matt likes to say, and that his therapy is going to be long and painful. And it's weird because in a TV show, his therapist actually becomes a secondary character, which I'll talk about later. But the reason why I mentioned that in here is because I think his therapist gets maybe one scene here. So
I expected that. When this gets dropped here, I'm like, okay, what I think is going to happen, I shouldn't be trying. I know I should just be taking it in. But when you start seeing a repeat, you start anticipating. But I'm like, okay, what we're going to have happen is the course of this movie is going to take place over the course of his rehabilitation. I'm like, okay, we see he even gets stronger as this power manifests or something along that route. And I think that's what I'm in for. And I think that would have been a smart idea because we suddenly jump to just a limp. And I don't know. You can cut stuff out if it doesn't matter to the rest of the film.
So Johnny grabs his doctor's hand and sees a war, saying that the wolf is loose, and he sees horses and a fire, and says that the boy is safe before falling over. He says that the doctor is the boy, and that his mother is safe and alive. He says that he knows her name and where she lives. We then cut to the doctor calling his mom, proving that Johnny was right. So another episode in this.
He becomes Sherlock Holmes. All intents and purposes, but more so the modern Sherlock Holmes, where he might as well have psychic powers.
So the doctor says that Johnny is in possession of either a new ability or a very old one, as he was right about his mother. And we see some therapy that Johnny is going through as Sarah emerges, saying that she didn't know whether she should have come or not. He compliments her haircut, and she compliments him on his coma weight loss. She goes in to talk about her 10-month-old baby Danny and tells him to stop looking at her like that. She asks why it had to happen like this and that she should have never let him go that night. And she goes on to say that he's the talk of the town because of his power of second sight. He brings up Sleepy Hollow again, Adam, and he says he doesn't want to be talked about anymore. And I think this is a big part of why I find this movie and book to be very autobiographical, because this character of Johnny is an English teacher when we meet him, and King himself was an English teacher. And I think a lot of this, especially in the book, is about him trying to go back to that, but he can't because he's more noticed now. He's familiar to people now.
Well, yeah, it's also the price you pay for fame, whether you want it or not. It's the exposure. It's people actively reaching out to you to get either advice or to get something from you. So I definitely see those components. I just find it funny that Cronenberg cast Herbert Lom to be his doctor.
Yes.
Because I thought for sure that meant he was going to be the big villain of this movie.
Wasn't he in the Pink Panther? Wasn't that where he was from?
Yeah, he was the chief inspector.
Yeah. God, my dad used to watch those nonstop. We then cut to Sarah crying in the car before driving off. Now, let's talk about the directing here, Matt. Specifically, Cronenberg's use of colors. Like, for example, Sarah's red sweater, it symbolizes warmth. And then later, he uses this dark green, almost Freddy's boiler room quality in Dodd's house when we get there. The way Johnny's collar is turned up, giving it an almost Ichabod Crane, Max Schreck feel throughout the course of this, which he admitted in the features was intentional on his part. Matt, as the big Cronenberg fan, how do you feel his directing is here?
I think there's a lot more of his stamp on this than people are willing to admit, because everyone's like, oh, there's no body horror, so there's no Cronenberg. I'm like, you people should realize that he's made movies that don't rely on that. I mean, look at the late 90s to COVID, he was not making those kind of movies. I mean, he made History of Violence.
Spider.
Which is also incredibly mainstream. Most people don't even know that's based on a comic book. But here, Dead Zone is ironic because a lot of people think Cronenberg's movies are also very kind of clinical and not very warm from an emotional standpoint. I think there's more here, so it kind of feels different from what he was doing. But as far as his directing goes, I never feel like he's asleep at the wheel. This very easily could have been a point-and-shoot type of movie. But I think he puts his own stamp on this. I mean, as much as some other directors maybe are more toned down than what they typically do, like Carpenter on Christine. But the flourishes are still there.
Even when we get to Frank Dodd later, the way the body twitches, that's strictly Cronenberg.
Oh, yeah.
And I also want to compliment him, too, because at one point later on the film, we're going to see Johnny warn somebody about falling in ice. And we don't know whether the dad had made the decision to pull him from the team. But the next day we see a newspaper that says that two people have drowned. And we cut to the same father who is sitting there solemn and looks like he's depressed. The phone rings. He reaches for it as Johnny's calling. And it's the boy who picks up the phone. And that's a really nice directorial touch. And that's stuff that I don't think if somebody like Carpenter would have done this, he wouldn't have done that.
And this is also a very well-edited movie as far as the ordering of scenes. And this is also Cronenberg's main editor. He basically worked with him all the way through Map to the Stars movie. I think because he brought in so many of his chief collaborators, it helps it feel more like his movie, even if the subject material doesn't warrant it in your estimation.
So Johnny talks to the press about how he could save the little girl, and then a reporter asks for a demonstration, and this is when Greg Stilson's name is mentioned. More on this later. The reporter walks up to have his hand touched, grabs his hands, and asks if he wants to know why his sister killed herself. Ouch. By the way, this reporter will come up later in a King story that we'll talk about years down the line. We then see his mom choke, and we cut to Johnny in the hospital. Man, this mother's death is handled in this very small way. It's a little bigger in the book.
This movie moves, and at the same time, there's long stretches where I am kind of bored, and I feel like the road is desolate that we're taking. I should feel something and care that his mom died, and I don't. And that's disappointing on the writing and the way that this is handled. I don't care, and I don't feel like he really does either. It's almost like we had to get her out of the picture for the rest of it. Maybe the book explained more because of that religious zealot that we get in other King's works, but it's not in this script, so it's just a passing moment.
Yeah, as I mentioned, she's a much bigger part of the book, and you're right. I think the way the movie handles it, it does look like it gets her out of the way pretty quick. He grabs his mom's hand and kisses it as she passes away. We then see a police car pull up to Johnny's house, and hey, welcome back to Percolated Media, Tom Skerritt.
Tom Skerritt.
Yep.
I can't wait to see him be a major part of the rest of this film. It's Tom Skerritt.
Now, this character, Bannerman, another character we're going to be talking about in the next couple weeks, so stay tuned for that. That being said, it should be mentioned, boys, and Matt, you're privy to this, right? This is the first Castle Rock story, which is a place he's going to be spending a lot of time in.
Yeah, I can see that.
I noticed that was one of the things I did catch was when they were talking about the murder that happened in Castle Rock. it was enough that it caught my notes where I'm like, wait, this is the first time that I think we've mentioned that, or, you know, specifically called it out.
So Bannerman compliments Johnny's dad on the Christmas tree and tells Johnny that he's here to give a proposal, which is for him to use his powers to help catch a serial killer. He says that he's exhausted every other resource that he has, and Johnny says that he's made a mistake by coming to him. The sheriff sends his condolences for his mom's death, and he goes on to say that he thinks if God's blessed him with this gift, he thinks you should use it. And we get a very famous Walken-esque monologue about how God indeed hasn't blessed him, but I love him here. I think he really sells this.
Yeah, I could use almost a little more of this. Look, I'm complaining about this movie being a little slow and dry for me, but I could use it a little longer and more of this stuff to be fleshed out. Because I think Walken does a good job with this character. I want to feel more of what he does.
Yeah, especially if you're going to axe the religious zealot mother, you could still have a conversation about, is this a gift from God or is it like a psychiatric issue that's explainable by science? I think you really could have expanded upon that here. Is it wrong just with his mental state? Is he going crazy? What is here, I think, is done well. But this whole subplot has been ruined for me by two words. South Park. Because there is an episode, and Adam probably will know what I'm talking about, where Cartman jumps off the roof of his house. And he wakes up, and the police come to him because he thinks he's psychic to go track down a serial killer. And it's him with a cane, with the bathrobe, at a crime scene. And it's shot almost exactly like this. And I cannot stop giggling.
God damn, is there something South Park hasn't lampooned?
Jesus. No.
It's been 25 years.
Johnny takes a pill as his dad comes and talks about the deaths that happened when Johnny was in a coma. He says he wishes his mom was here to talk about this. And Johnny says that when the spells come, it feels like he's dying inside and then it should snow for Christmas. In the book, it does explain that there is a tumor inside his head and he is going to die. He is on a clock. In the movie, it's explained that it's his visions that are killing him. And each time he has a vision, he loses a part of his life. Again, Matt, Cronenberg's kind of condensing this, isn't he?
Yeah, but I like that every time he uses his quote unquote gift, it slowly kills him.
I do too. But you know what it made me think of? It made me think of Dr. Sleep, that not only does he have the shine, but he's more of a vampire, that it's sucking the life out of him when he uses it.
That's a good comparison. Yeah.
I made that stretch.
We see Sarah show up with her son and says that she's brought a visitor. She says that he looks wonderful as she introduces him to Denny, not Danny, as in The Shining. He invites them in and she puts Denny to bed. And she says that the last time they were alone together, he said that some things were worth waiting for and that she has waited long enough.
I mean, sometimes they come back.
You know what, though? This is one of the sweetest sex scenes I've ever seen. Look, the chick's cheating on her husband, so it's not like it's a good thing that this is happening, but it's very sweet.
That was my first note. I got finished. I'm like, wait a minute, isn't she still married?
Yeah.
You know, because I wondered if there was something edited out that I was going to miss. It happens in these 80s films. It's a sweet moment. I think it's going to have a bigger reaction to the rest of the film, but no, it's really just a sweet moment that's going to happen between them.
And she disappears till the end, so you're right, it doesn't really have much of an impact.
No.
She must be married to Cyclops. Because this is a freaking Jean Grey Wolverine thing.
We cut to Johnny sitting with Danny as his dad walks in with a high chair. They sit for dinner as his dad says that it feels good to have a family eating around the table again. Johnny asks if he's ever going to see her again, and she says, not like today, and he kisses her goodnight, and she leaves. When he comes back in the house, he sees a newscast that says the killer is still on the loose, and the sheriff says his line is always open and he could use all the help he can get as he looks at the camera. And this convinces Johnny to help after all. So we cut to Bannerman and Johnny in a tunnel, and this is a scene that's always stuck out to me. They found this in Canada, and of course, as Matt mentioned, this was one of the coldest movie shoots ever, and this tunnel was nonetheless the same, but what they ended up doing was they ended up spraying the inside of this tunnel and had it freeze so that it gives that pastel look that's here. It is a very harrowing scene. I love the image of them going in this tunnel as they see a set of cigarette butts, and Bannerman gives them back where the cigarettes were. Johnny feels it and says he doesn't feel a thing. And again, this tunnel's look, it just looks cold as hell here.
Yeah, this looks like one of the tunnels that Pennywise would be sleeping in.
Yes.
It looks good. I start to get confused because he's like, wait, I have a pack of those same brand of cigarettes. And he gives it to him. And I'm like, what the hell's that going to do? That's like saying the guy drives a Ford. Hey, I do too. Come put your hands on my car.
Bannerman gets a call that they found another body. They go to it, and it's located in a gazebo. They uncover it, and Dodd says that he knows her. So Johnny goes to the body, uncovers her hand, and the Friday 13th type sound that happens here when he sees the visions, he sees that it was indeed Dodd who did it, and he reveals surgical scissors. And for a Cronenberg film, this wasn't bloody or explicit, and I remember reviews pointing that out at the time, Matt, where it was just like, well, the movie is very well done, even if it's not in the vein of the reputations of both King and Cronenberg. Matt, were you missing the explicit violence here?
No, because in his other movies, it has a point, especially in Videodrome, especially the guy who melts at the end. Like, there's a very clear message with that. I think it would have just felt gratuitous or out of obligation to have a murder that's bloody and gruesome. I'm glad there's some restraint because it would feel really disconnected from the rest of the movie.
I agree with that.
Yeah, 100%. I think it would have felt like just because Cronenberg's there, you got to do it. And I think what Cronenberg does works. And I think maybe that it's not what people associate with him specifically is why it works so well. Because what he's directing and shooting is very well done.
When Johnny says it was Dodd that he saw, the sheriff calls for him and finds out that he has taken off in his car. They go to his house and the sheriff tells Johnny to stay by the door. Dodd's mom answers the door saying that he wasn't here. And in the book, this character, it's kind of implied here in the movie. I don't know what it was about this time in King with moms, but she was also just a terrible character. She knew of the killings that were going on. And in fact, this was a very abusive mother-son relationship to the point where she would actually put clothespins on his dick in the book. Yeah, it's so insane the way this relationship is in the book. Here you still get that feeling as they walk in. As I mentioned, when you walk in here, it's so darkly green and dreadful that you know something bad's going on. And of course, when they go in the Dodd's bedroom, he has these infantile wallpaper where it's kind of like these dinosaurs, so you can still see that he hasn't really gotten past that little boy stage. And we see Dodd lock himself in the bathroom, and I remember this being very explicit in the book. In the book, he takes scissors and he cuts his throat with the scissors. But as this is going on, Johnny finds out that Dodd's mom knew of the killings, and we see him pull scissors out of a jar and fall on them mouth first. A lot going on there.
That escalated quickly.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I thought this was, it was a heck of a kill, or not kill, but suicide that I wasn't expecting. Oof, brutal.
And again, just like in other Cronenberg works, when they discover the body, it's twitching, and Cronenberg does that a lot in his movies. By the way, stay tuned. Frank Dodd does come back in future King projects. So
yeah, because sometimes they come back.
Yep. Johnny senses this suicide as the sheriff opens the door to find Dodd in the bathtub. So Dodd's mom appears and shoots Johnny right before the sheriff shoots and kills her. We see the doctor pull up to Johnny's house and Johnny lets him in. By the way, since when does a tutoring gig get you a house like this?
Yeah, you gotta love those private school systems.
Jesus!
My God. Because he was teaching public elementary, he wouldn't be living there.
Maybe Jen's right. Maybe I should get into teaching. Holy shit. Johnny lets the doctor in and they talk about how Johnny moved to a new town and that his dad is worried about him. He says that the bullet that was shot at him went right through him as he grabs his head, and he says that he has 3 or 4 huge headaches a day. Johnny doesn't want any more pills. As he's not getting better, he feels like he's getting worse. Doctor then says that he's done research on psychic phenomenon, and in all cases, as the visions become more powerful, the body weakens. He asks Johnny to come back to the clinic so that they can reverse the process, but Johnny refuses as he shows him the quote-unquote fan letters of people who want reassurance, help, and love that he cannot give them.
This I like quite a bit. It just showed part of what more he's suffering with, that it's there. He knows there's going to be a price to pay if he helps. He can't do it. He wants to do it. He doesn't know if there's good to do. Oh, God, I could have used just a little more into delving into all these and just what it means for him to not open these letters. But I like what's here. Again, I'm complaining about stuff that I want because I do think there's something to be stretched out. I think the truncated part of this is just leaving me a little empty, but I love this part because it's just, this has an impact.
Go to the TV show because it delves more on this.
Nope.
Yeah, I'm sort of in unison with Adam as far as I would have liked a little bit more of this, the rejection of celebrity, because this is very much King getting fan letters and sometimes being borderline stalked.
Which he will write about 4 years after this movie. So Johnny says that he can't go on, and he says that he'll stay locked up as he already lives in a controlled environment. Here, he's alone and safe. We cut to a tutor session that Johnny's conducting as we meet Roger Stewart. He walks in and says that his son needs help as he won't take part in school activities, and he's so shy that he's not functioning. He says he needs Johnny to come to the house and meet him, but even though this goes against Johnny's ethics, Johnny agrees to do it anyway. Now this character, this little boy, in the book, he was a teenager. He was a jock. He was not picked on. He was just kind of needing help to get through in school. And in the book, it results in, it's kind of convoluted, but it goes into how lightning strikes a gymnasium during a school dance and he dies. That's what he sees when he grabs the boy's hand. Here, it's down to a little boy. And you know what? As a kid, I gravitated to this character. Cronenberg said that the reason why he cut the gymnasium now is because it was too much like Carrie. He wanted to do something a little different. And I think this works. Matt, is this another set of proof that Cronenberg was right in how he adapted this story?
Yeah, and I also like the scenario that happens because it's so much more plausible than lightning striking. You have better chances of being hit by a car than you do being struck by lightning. So I like that he kept it literally grounded. I also love how we get another Bond alumni in this.
Yep. I was wondering if you caught that.
It's the guy from License to Kill.
Mm-hmm. Adam, what do you think about this? And do you agree with that decision?
I agree with the decision completely. That would have so much felt like a retread. And as we discussed, that ended up being problematic with a lot of these works. My only problem with this is he rejects everybody else. But because this dude shows up to his door, he just says, okay. Well, shit, man. You got a closet full of letters.
It's tied into academics. That's why.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And the guy's loaded.
Yeah.
It's just convenient enough to move on. But I like walking with this kid, and I like all these parts with the boy.
You try helping little people and affording a house like that.
When you're as tall as you are, everybody's a little person. That's not fair. Sorry, Jen. I love you.
Johnny is a good guy trying to do good, even if his body tells him not to. So we look out the window as a Make America Great Again. I mean, Greg Stilson poster is being completed. And we cut to Greg.
My goodness.
We cut to Greg Stilson himself being about as big a blowhard as Martin Sheen can play. This comes about the 53-minute mark. And I would say that was about 30 minutes too late. Adam, how do you like Martin Sheen here?
I had no idea this was coming.
Oh,
I had no idea. I don't look at a cast list because I want, especially when some of these are the first time. So one, when I first got the glimpse, I was like, oh my God, he looks like Emilio so much in this. And I know his other son is actually in this, but Emilio is a dead ringer. Wait, no, different Cronenberg. Is a dead ringer for him. This blew me away. And the first thing I thought of is, oh, Matt's got to absolutely love this. Just because of the West Wing and that shit.
Yeah.
You know, and the president. But I was just like, holy shit, it's Martin Sheen. And then, of course, I went to where this world is today. And I couldn't help but see parallels from 40 years ago, you know?
Yeah, King's made that parallel, too. He's written about it.
Well, that connection is obvious, but this is the antithesis of who we played on the West Wing in almost every capacity. This is also very much a direct middle finger to Reagan and the whole cult of personality he had around him. I mean, this character is basically the hellspawn of Kennedy, of JFK, and Reagan. And the most unplausible thing in this movie is that a third-party candidate would be elected president. That's the most ridiculous concept of this entire movie.
Where's Ross Perot when we need him?
He borders on being camp. And might as well be Mexico because he's this close to crossing the border. But I think he's a lot of fun in this. But I will say, I think it's King. I wonder if this tracks in the book, him putting his political opinions on full blast in the same way that he goes after evangelicals. He has a lot to say about Republicans and the conservative right.
Definitely. He was starting that here. You say Reagan. I say Nixon. And I say that just because of how similar the last name is to Nixon. And I mentioned that this was King's pretty much middle finger to the 70s, not just politics. And this feels like Nixon to me, especially the way he greets the crowds and everything. And you know fucking Martin Sheen, him being the liberal that he is playing this up for all it's worth. And I think he does a tremendous job here. I actually did not remember him being as lovably campy as he is here.
As much as it seems like it's over the top and almost like a skit with how much he's just bloviating in the 80s, maybe, in the 2020s.
Nope. Not so much.
Yeah, that's one of the things that has aged. Sadly, it's aged really well. That's the tragic thing. But this is kind of why I could see, because he was talked about being Two-Face at Batman Forever. I could kind of see this performance being the reason why he was looked at.
In the book, it's even more over the top. He's introduced as bragging about a time he kicked a dog. I'm not kidding. And of course, he shows up much earlier. He starts his plans and everything around the time that Johnny wakes up, and in fact, it's implied that his election is what kind of wakes him up, because at that point, he's kind of looked at as an angel sent to kind of protect people from this evil political character. So I think you're hit on the head, Matt. I think he was starting his political pontificating around this time. So we see Johnny show up and get a pin from Stilson as he leaves, and then we go to meet Roger's son, Chris. Roger leaves, and Johnny says that he has no idea how to bring Chris out of his shell. Chris says that it's actually his dad who lives in a shell, not him. We see them walking outside, seemingly getting acquainted as Roger looks at them from the window. He says that he's impressed with how Johnny is with Chris and then gets a beer even though he turned it down. We then cut to Stilson completing push-ups on TV in the thick of his campaign. Jesus Christ.
It's RFK.
Man, the way he says, what the hell's happened to our country, that reminds me of someone, yet I just can't picture who. Roger says that it's weird how people can't see through Stilson, and this is how politics works, isn't it? We then see Brenner show up and see Stilson and an associate in his office. Stilson says he's damn near even in the polls, and he had a vision that he was going to be president of the United States, as Adam pointed out earlier, and that no one was going to stop him. He says that he saw the editorial that was going to be printed, and he doesn't like it. Stilson shows Brenner a picture of him with another lady other than his wife. He says that he's going to give Brenner some time to think about where he stands with his wife and kids. If he doesn't make a deal, Sonny will take his goddamn head off.
This shit's almost autobiographical. This might as well be a fucking documentary.
Right. Adam, you're the political one. What do you say here?
I never get political. I don't know what you're talking about. I just, it amazes me how at some point this was so fanciful that even though you knew there was dark shit going on, none of it was so public. This might as well be the CBS Evening News right now.
Right. You
know, this isn't even in back rooms anymore.
That's true.
I'm going to say, taking it back to this movie, I feel like we did three quarters of setup that was a completely different realm. And then we are just kind of like sprinting towards the end here once we meet Stilson. And I wasn't expecting it. I'm kind of wondering, why am I seeing Sarah, her husband, Stilson all at the same time? Hold to that. Because I'm just like, why is this tying together? But I'm intrigued because Martin Sheen suddenly brings some much, I don't want to say needed because I've enjoyed it, but he brings another level of what's going on. But it seems like we do kind of, I don't want to say take a hard turn, but we weave around the milk truck to go down the road once he shows up.
Yeah, this wouldn't have felt as much of a turn as it is if there were campaign ads throughout the movie or you saw his picture.
Something on TV earlier in the film would have helped, just an ad on TV. Yeah, that's a good point.
Just so you know, it's happening. But also, Adam saying he's not political, I think he was directly quoting George Lucas.
What about trade routes now, bitch?
It should be said that in the amazing book on writing, which I recommend people check out, the book that King put out about writing, his process of writing, he mentioned his impetus for doing this book was he wanted to try to make Lee Harvey Oswald a protagonist, wanted to make him sympathetic, if there was a way he could do that, and if he could make... Yeah, that was what he said. He said if there's a way he can make an audience care
right now.
Right. If there's a way he can make an audience care about a political assassin, that was his in for writing this book. That being said, all this backroom stuff and all this stuff where, you know, Martin Sheen's like, I need your money, ha ha ha, as he's laughing. This is really leading up to a character that we want to see dead.
Yeah.
That was so King's intent.
He's also exaggerated because the movie does not have a villain. And King, you know, all of his books have a clear antagonist. Or most of them do, I should say. Especially up to this point. It's very binary. The good people are good, albeit they could be mistreated and go bad. And then you had people that are just objectively bad. And did Oliver Stone read that quote and say, a whole movie about that? Because that's basically, in large part, what JFK is.
You're not wrong.
You know what's funny, though? We may get to this movie someday, but he almost plays the same character 10 years down the road in Spawn.
Oh, my God.
We cut to Johnny helping Chris, who's reading Edgar Allan Poe, of course. Johnny's doorbell rings, and why would a guy with a bum leg get a house with stairs? That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, you think at very least he'd have a chair that links to the railway so you can go up it?
We see a pollster for Stilson at his door giving away brochures, and we see that this pollster is actually the husband of Sarah.
God, that's coincidence.
Oh, wait till I mention the coincidence when we get done with this. I'll talk about the TV show. Walt says, it's nice to finally meet Johnny as he's heard an awful lot about him. Johnny closes the door and he's having a hard time gathering his bearings as he hugs Chris and then has visions of him drowning in a lake playing hockey. But you know what? Before we get to that, I felt for Walt in here. I think this is when he's at his best. I think this is his best moment in the film, even after the whole, oh, it's been good to me speech. Here, he's actually crying and that tore me up when I first watched this as a kid.
Yeah, I feel for this quite a bit. First, I wonder almost if it's a setup, and it's not. But I kind of feel for everybody. It's not his fault. It's not Sarah's fault. It's not her husband's fault. Everybody's victim may be too strong a word, but it's just a weird set of coincidences. But to your point specifically on a walk-in, he's great here. The emotion that he plays across his face when he's acting as opposed to acting is just really, really well done. I wish I knew more of him of this style because this is really good.
This part has my favorite, like the most memorable gif from this movie of the ice is gonna break.
Oh no, that's later.
Oh yeah, that's a little bit later, but that's like the most memorable scene for this movie.
So he's hugging Chris and then has visions of him drowning in a lake while playing hockey. And as I mentioned earlier, this was way different in the book where it was just a gymnasium being caught on fire. So Johnny goes to Roger and sees that he's organizing a hockey team. Johnny asks them to call it off. And this is, Matt, when we get your favorite scene, when he says that the ice is gonna break. wonderful, wonderful scene. Apparently he wasn't supposed to break that glass on that table on that take, but he did it anyway. And it threw the whole set decoration.
Yeah, he pulled it to DiCaprio.
Yeah. Roger says that he doesn't want Johnny in his son's life anymore and follows it up with, "We'll never know whether you're right or not." He bids Chris goodbye and then leaves. And then we see Chris at that, Adam, remember these old school computers with these green screens?
Yes.
Wonder if he's playing Oregon Trail. Roger comes back in and says that he didn't really call off the game. He just said that to get rid of Johnny. Johnny comes home and sees the paper, which says that the two drown in a skating accident. He tries calling Roger, but he won't answer. And it's Chris who answers. And this gives Johnny relief as it means that Chris is safe. And as I mentioned, I just think this is wonderful directing. And Cronenberg films this so nicely. We get a close-up of Roger, and it's not until he pulls back Chris into frame that we know that he's okay. Just wonderfully done. Adam, is it safe to say that you like the second half here more than the first?
I do. A lot more has happened. It's not that I didn't mind the first half. It's just I don't think the steps are even to get to where it's going. The car's sputtering along. The clutch needed to pop. And that setup is needed for what we get. But the film's just not balanced. It's almost like you got two acts instead of three. I like what we got going on here. A lot is happening. But I do feel like we are just kind of sprinting towards a finale. Because everything is just coming into play and the cards are being laid out very quickly here.
I'm fully on board with this because I like that the quote-unquote cases he's working with are both getting more interpersonal but are also escalating the level of potential catastrophe. So it's kind of superseding the lack of a true third act. I mean, this movie really doesn't have a second act, but it kind of offsets that by the ultimate, like, what is the end game that they're building towards?
We cut to a stop at the campaign trail when Johnny gets up and sees that Sarah has left the car. He walks out amongst the chaos as Stilson shows up, and there are chants as he walks around in a hard hat. He gets to Johnny, who grabs his hand and sees him setting off a nuclear bomb to fulfill his destiny. Now, this is very cheesily done, but it's shorthand, because in the book, when Johnny grabs his hand, he sees that he's going to cause World War III. This is Cronenberg saying it very, very long, shorthand. And Adam, you remember this. When we were in school, we'd have to get under desks, because of course that would be protect us from nuclear war. The idea of a president having access to a button like this scared the living shit out of me as a teenager.
Well, we got to have a point of order. If a refrigerator can stop a nuclear war, why can't a wooden desk? And granted, you have to be able to fit into it, but...
We weren't too far removed from the Cuban Missile Crisis at that time, so that was being taught as, like, new history. Shoot, when we were there, the Berlin Wall had just come down, like, 2 years before. There were still parts of it there. Sorry, kids, look up East and West Germany.
Yeah.
Because I don't think they teach that anymore. So, yeah, this is very prophetic for the days then and now, sadly. But, yeah, nuclear war. I mean, go back and watch 13 Minutes, you know. Oof. But, yeah, this is something that definitely would have been... This would have been the scary thing to put in a film, especially with it being reality.
It should be said, too, that in the book, it kind of goes Forrest Gump, because he also grabs the hand of Jimmy Carter, and he sees that he's going to become president, and he sees that he's going to be a good guy.
And I could kind of, like, I would almost, you know, if you were going to do this a little bit different, though I like Cronenberg's take on the way that he shoots this, is I'd almost like to see this character just being in the scene as it's going on around him. You know, just something so that you can understand that he's feeling what's going on. Just because I want more than the Shine type of vision.
Yeah, I'm trying to think how you would visualize that. Like, he's standing there behind the desk when he pushes the button.
Yeah.
Like, you can do so. I mean, look, this was, like, my grandmother used to say every other day. Now I heard this secondhand because I didn't live through this time. She used to always say, like, you know, Reagan's going to push the button any day now. Like, I mean, my grandmother was very nihilistic. But, you know, Watchmen is all about that. Almost everything. The Terminator is a direct reflection of that. So much of the 80s was that we were going to blow ourselves up.
Stay tuned.
Yeah. We cut to Johnny at home with his doctor, and we have a debate of whether or not you'd kill Hitler.
Of course, you asked the guy who fought in World War II.
Yes.
But this is one of those discussions.
Yes, it is.
So I was in, I think I mentioned it before, but I was in an advanced placement government class for my last year. And for part of it, we dressed up and we debated the two sides. So we had people that in high school, you would never do this today, had to defend and debate as Germany. And defend their actions. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, it was, okay, would you be right to go back and kill Hitler in his crib? Which is almost a punchline, you know, in a lot of things, you know, that's done.
Avengers made it a punchline.
Yeah. But back then, I mean, it would such an effective thought process, and it's that trolley on the track. You know, would you actually be able to pull the lever? Do you kill one to save five? So I love this type of morality discussion.
Forrest Whitaker hosted a version of The Twilight Zone back in like 2002, 2003, something like that. And they did a whole episode on this where somebody was sent back in time to do this. And it was one of the few real gripping episodes of that series. I recommend people going check out.
Yeah, it's one of the only good episodes of that reboot.
Yeah. So Johnny tells his doctor about the blank spot dead zone that he experienced, which was saving the boy from drowning. The doctor says that not only can he see the future, he can change it, which again is his dead zone. And I'm with Matt. I really like the way Cronenberg and Bohm have changed this from the way King had it in the book. I think it makes more sense to an audience.
It's also dead zone exists in the same place as dead lights.
The doctor says that he is a man of medicine, but he'd have no choice but to kill the son of a bitch. I love that. Johnny then grabs his rifle, located right by his dresser. Not a good place while he's tutoring, by the way. He loads.
What happens if he grabs that, you know, when he goes to get a glass of water at night?
Exactly.
Instead of his cane, you know, he could blow his head off.
Exactly. He loads his gun and heads off, writing a letter to Sarah about what he's doing and how much he knows what he's doing is right. We see him, gun in tow, break the window of a rally location and make his way in. We cut to people showing up, including Stilson himself, as Johnny loads and readies his gun. Stilson's making the rounds as Johnny loads his. What a weird location, this place that Johnny is in. Like, how much room is here?
Yeah, this rally is ridiculously proportioned.
Yes.
But this is, I have to credit King for this. This is a great ethical dilemma of the Ozymandias principle. Do you take a life to save millions? I think this is a great way to kind of tie in. Just because you can see the future, A, there's no guarantee that it's 100% correct. And B, does that give you the right to change it as a singular person? This is something that could have been in the original Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
Especially when that was coming out. It was as heightened with nuclear war as the 80s were.
Mm-hmm. And if you change it, what are the results of that? Does that mean that it won't happen? Does it mean just somebody else does it? Yeah. Is the future set?
Now we're going to get into like the Terminator rule of like Judgment Day is inevitable. Like you only postponed it a month. You click delay payment.
But at this point, I almost wish that he could be having a philosophical discussion with his mother, or that he was fighting with that. But again, there's a different story there. But there's those thoughts are gone, but it should be a part of the story because she was that religious ideologue.
Yeah, and she was too crazy to have discussions like this with. If you read the book, she's not really likable at all, and Johnny didn't really have a good relationship with her in that book. So I do like that he chooses the doctor to have that discussion with. But again, another character has disappeared. Where's his dad?
Oh, shit, that's right.
Yeah.
Wait a minute, where's Tom Skerritt?
Well, he's busy.
You hired Tom Skerritt. Why is Tom Skerritt not in this film a lot more?
Because his episode's over.
Let's hold up the rifle, have a walkie-talkie, and say, how am I looking, Goose?
That'll be 3 years later. We see Sarah with her baby as Sheen does his best Nixon impression. I think Sheen is fucking relishing in this. I love every second he's on screen. He gives a speech, and Johnny stands up, missing Stilson in the process. And King will admit that he copped out at this point. He saw himself becoming a more popular author, and he was scared that somebody would try assassinating the president and have this book in his possession. And so he had him miss. But 2 years earlier, somebody had already tried assassinating Reagan, so I'm not sure how well that would have come off.
Shoot, I thought this was going to go so dark, I was wondering if he was going to shoot the baby.
Oh, yeah. That's like, right. He hadn't seen this. He didn't know what was going to happen here.
No, but the ending of this is dark. It goes dark, and then it goes really dark, and then it goes really fucking dark. You know, I appreciated that because I do think King pulls his punches a lot. I don't think he's got the stones for a lot of what he wants to do. And this, I think this is done the right way. Yeah, I think anytime, especially back then, I don't know if the MPAA would have let you put it out a film where you showed somebody assassinate the president, especially when at that point, two of the last four had been shot. So it would have been either two of the last five. So it would have been a risky way to go. But I like this setup. I like that it takes its time to breathe a little bit before it gets there. And though I got to say, Secret Service, there's how do you not sweep your eaves, man? Come on.
Right. If you want dark, we'll talk about the original ending of this. It gets well dark. You know what I saw a lot of with this? And Matt, see if you agree with me. Did you see some taxi driver here?
Oh, absolutely.
Where, mm-hmm. I mean, of course, he's not as dark as the De Niro character is in that. But still, you have an isolated guy. You have a guy who keeps to himself, who is finding it in himself to stop a political figure. It's kind of the same thing, isn't it?
President for Jimmy Foster.
Yeah. Finding the connection there. But yeah, certainly both in their minds think they're doing the thing for the quote-unquote greater good. So, yeah, I could totally see that.
So, Stilson holds up the baby to protect him as Johnny is shot and he falls. Now, in the book, this is just some random baby that Stilson grabbed, not Sarah's baby. So, they changed it. They made it a little too coincidental, but I think it works for the story they're telling.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a little contrived that there's one baby in the vicinity, but this is the also King saying, like, yeah, we're going from kissing babies to potentially using a baby as a human shield, which is the complete 180 of what politicians designed them for, because really they use kissing babies to get brownie points.
Yes.
Oftentimes. So I do think there's some commentary there, but I guess it's a good thing that he's a terrible shot.
Yeah.
Only because I didn't feel like that she would have been somebody who would have been standing side by side with Stilson. So that's the only part that's a little off. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's a perfect way, because you see politicians grab babies, pick them up, bring them in for a kiss. So to invert that and have them hold them up as a shield, fuck. Look, we know the guy in office would do the same goddamn thing.
I was so just about ready to say, do we think this would actually get somebody impeached, or would this actually increase their popularity? 99%
of politicians would not get elected. Yeah. 99% of them.
Yeah. Stilson asks Johnny who he is, as Johnny has a vision of Stilson on the cover of Newsweek holding up the baby and killing himself. Johnny says that it's over, as Stilson gets on a mission to get the pics that were taken. By the way, as Adam mentioned, this was Ramon Estevez, Martin Sheen's other kid, who was the photographer here.
This scene, though, of him actually putting the... because you see a handgun, uh-huh. And then it pans back that you see him put it to himself, and then the blood splatter. Oh, my God.
That blood splatter was done by Cronenberg himself. He just took a handful of it and just whipped it right on the magazine, which I thought was cool.
That gave me chills. It was just so... Mm-hmm. It was so darkly effective.
Meanwhile, Sarah asks Johnny why. As she embraces him, he tells her goodbye, and the last words he hears are the words, "I love you," done in post. As you can tell, I think you guys can tell that this was this was dubbed in, because the original ending to this, boys, was Johnny survives this, and we find out that the Castle Rock killer is on the loose because he escaped from prison, and he has Sarah hostage, and Johnny has to save her. And it goes dark, dark, dark. Boom, like that ending. De Laurentiis apparently liked the ending. The only one who didn't like it was the man himself, David Cronenberg. He's the one who nixed it. And Matt, thank God he did.
Well, that's all right, because De Laurentiis got to make that with Manhunter.
That's true. Good that's call.
That's literally the ending of Manhunter / Red Dragon.
Yeah, that's a very good call.
Adam, yeah, it would have been too ridiculous if he survived this. Because, like, at bare minimum, he would have been arrested, brutally arrested on the spot. But... it's far more plausible somebody would have shot him, which is what happens.
Yep. Adam, would you have agreed with that ending?
No, don't need that whatsoever. I think it ends here properly. I thought we were going to get one final vision once he touched Sarah. I was waiting for either he was going to see that family be happy or her standing over his own grave, something of that sort. So I thought his death was going to culminate with him watching a vision.
I got to say, dubbed or not, this ending got me. When he dies, just hearing her utter the words, "I love you," that really got to me. And I got emotional. And I don't remember getting emotional. Well, maybe The Fly a few years later. That would get you emotional. But here, like, I don't remember getting emotional at a Cronenberg film. And here we are. So I agree with this ending, too. So credits roll on The Dead Zone, boys. Scale of 1 to 10. What? Do we get
credits instantly roll?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We're done.
It's the same thing as The Fly. She blows his head off and then the movie just cuts.
Exactly. Good call. Scale of 1 to 10, boys. What do we give The Dead Zone? Adam, go ahead, sir.
First time seeing this movie, had heard, I think I knew more about the name than anything else. Christopher Walken. Hey, this kid's got a good career ahead of him. I think this Walken kid's going to be doing some stuff. Keep your eye out. This was one of those stories that could have went a lot of ways. You could almost do this as a choose your own adventure freaking RPG, and I would be really into what's going on. The cast, I think, does a really good job. Not just the leads like Walken and Brooke Adams and who is it? Herbert Lom as a doctor. But I think all the supporting cast actually also do a really good job of shoring up the story. It's pacing, I think, is a little wonky. You know, it sprints and then walks and then sprints and then walks. And I think that hurts a little bit, but the performances carry through. The story is a short one. I mean, it's pretty simple. Other than the setup at the beginning, we get one crime scene and then we get the finale. So there could have been stretching out of a little bit more of what's going on. But all in all, I think it's a solid film. I think it's pretty simple through and through. Like, it's not as complex as some of the other ones, and I think that may help it. the redundancies that we get from King stuff before, it bugs me as I'm watching it. But luckily, people like Walken, like Rook Adams, and the really, really good directing of Cronenberg, the good editing, the fantastic score helped this thing along. I'm at a good 7. Good movie. Not a great movie, but a really good movie for $1.43. It almost overstays its welcome, but it doesn't. Anytime it starts to lull a little bit, it catches itself back up. So I'm at a good solid 7. Dead Zone's a good zone to be in.
I was not expecting a 7. Honestly, that kind of surprised me, actually. Matt?
You know, after slogging through 11 Children of the Corn movies and some other Stephen King adaptations in Night Shift that I was not fond of, this was like a drink of water in the middle of the desert after I was dying for 3 days in the Gobi nearly at death's door, because I'm so happy to finally get another Stephen King movie that I like. And I say movie because I have not read the book. And I think a lot of, for something that does not scream Cronenberg, you have to give him the vast amount of credit for why this movie is as successful as it is, and Bohm by extension for being able to convert that book into this style, truncate it as well as he does for something that's under 2 hours. I appreciate the efficiency. Yeah, there's some very minor narrative shortcuts and some things that could have been expanded upon a bit more here or there, but I think this is one of, up to this point, outside of The Shining, this is probably my favorite of the King entries we've talked about thus far. And I think if you're looking for one to check out that is not of the level of like a Carrie or The Shining or The Shawshank Redemption as far as like name recognition, because this one has a name, but it doesn't have the following that those do, there's a lot here that I think people will like. So I'm going to go a little bit higher than Adam. Say very, very strong 8/10 for me.
Yeah, I'm on the side of Matt as well. And he took the angle that I was going to take in. After reviewing what we have reviewed of King's adaptations the last 2 years, to get this, I was so excited to talk about it. And I text you guys during the week in that I could not wait to talk about this movie, because I think this is not only a huge step up from The Children of the Corn, from a lot of other things we have reviewed, but it's everybody at the height of their powers, which is what I love. It was King getting ready to let loose, but it was Cronenberg. Cronenberg's directing here. I haven't really given him as much credit as I maybe should have as a director. I like his style. I've always liked a lot of his films, but at the same time, I find him sometimes, at least when I used to watch his movies back in my mid to late teens, I could never really connect with him. This movie actually is making me want to go back and watch a lot of his other stuff, because I find a lot of the flourishes here, stuff that only he could do. And I think it was in the right hands here. If they'd given it to Stanley Donen and he would have done with it, I don't think you could have had what was done here. And I think this is the work of a director who was trying to get back on his 2 feet after just getting beat down by the studio system in the years prior. And this is him being relaxed. And Walken, I think, is at the height here. This is 11 years before Pulp Fiction, and he would pretty much become a parody after that. But Matt is right. This era of Walken is very underrated. You watch this, you watch King of New York, and I will even put Communion in there. Even though Communion's not a very good movie, I think he is excellent in it. This is very solid Walken. My only real ding on the cast is Brooke Adams. I just don't think she adds too much. And I said the same thing on the Sometimes They Come Back podcast, where she has a pretty smile, but she uses that motherfucker like nothing else in her work, and I think she tries to get by with that. But everyone else is really good. Martin Sheen, I could not believe how much I did like him here. Let's see if I see that in a week or two. But oh, yeah. God, that's, yeah. But he is so fun here. And I'm going to go a half point higher than Matt. I want to go 8.5. I really enjoyed this movie. That being said, people who are used to like long, very elongated storytelling are going to probably have a problem with this, because it is rushed. This thing fucking moved. There is not one dull moment in this movie. I don't care what Adam says. Like, this movie, you cannot get more efficient than you can here. And that, I'm going to give a lot of credit to that to Jeffrey Blum as well. I really dinged him when we did those Lethal Weapon podcasts, but he really did a great job with this novel, which was about 450 pages or so, and he condensed it to a very efficient, very nicely done hour and 40 minutes. So 8.5 out of 10 for the Dead Zone movie. But boys, I did something as research for this that I didn't think I was going to do, but I did it anyway. I binged 6 seasons of the Dead Zone TV show. This came out 19 years after the movie itself. It starred Anthony Michael Hall as the Christopher Walken character. Now, let me say this. I almost had us all watch the first 2 episodes, because those first 2 episodes are pretty much this movie, where the first episode is of him getting in the car crash and waking up from his coma and trying to recognize everybody. And the second episode is of him saving the boys from drowning. That's your movie. The last part of this movie, the third act of Stilson, get this, guys, never gets solved. they elongate it and elongate it and elongate it through 6 seasons. Now, the way this movie, this show had come about, there were two guys who worked on a couple things of Star Trek. They were brought on, they came up with the idea of this, and they brought on some writers of the X-Files. They brought on some Star Trek writers as well to do this. And you know what? Matt, believe it or not, it reminded me a lot of the X-Files, because there are parts of this that are the quote-unquote mythology episodes, which is Johnny trying to stop Stilson, who's played by Sean Patrick Flannery, by the way. He's trying to stop Stilson from getting elected and getting in power, and the other episodes are of him kind of like the Incredible Hulk TV show, where it's kind of him helping other people out. Like in one episode, which was very good, he is coaching a hockey team and he sees the star hockey player. If he gets on in the game, he's going to have a heart attack. He has some issues with his heart and he's benching him, and everybody's trying to get him in the game, but he's refusing, and everybody's not knowing why he's refusing. So there's a lot of episodes like that where he's battling with the public to convince them that he is right. And it's a lot of like the X-Files, where it's a creature of the week. I was surprised how much I did like it. Now, it does start to lose a little bit of steam, I'd say around the middle of the 5th season and into the 6th. They brought Tom Skerritt in to play Johnny's father, as a matter of fact. Johnny's father, who actually died in the 1st season, is shown to actually be alive in the 6th season. So it kind of jumped a couple sharks at that point, but I really liked it. I would not recommend people check it out, though, because the final act is just not solved. Stilson's still alive, and Johnny's never able to solve that. But Matt, had you heard about this series? Had you seen any of it?
I know of its existence because it was on a lot when I was a kid, but I've never had the, for lack of a better word, never had the time to sit down and watch 6 seasons. I mean, that seems way too elongated.
Yeah. And they also did something really smart, too, where instead of Sarah's husband being this random guy who's helping Stilson, she actually married Sheriff Bannerman. And her kid in that show is not the kid of Bannerman, but is the kid of Johnny himself. So there's a little bit of a love triangle going on there, which is very nicely done. I do recommend the first couple episodes. If people have a chance, check out the first couple episodes at least. Just don't try to get too invested, because again, the Greg Stilson stuff does not get solved. Adam, had you seen any episodes of this show?
I hadn't seen it, knew of it. I knew Anthony Michael Hall was a part of it, and supposedly is really kind of like revitalized himself with it. But no, heard it was good. But yeah, I'm not watching 6 seasons of something that is this long. Hey, I'm almost through The Sopranos, everybody. But it's different when I only got 10 to 12 episodes of a season to watch.
Yeah, and this is at the time, right at the tail end of that 20 to 23 episode season.
Bitch, I can't believe it takes us out that long. But I know it's like it was for UPN, and then USA was like, we'll take it.
No, it's the opposite. USA had it, and then I believe CBS was the one that scooped it up. And yeah, it died a horrible death, which is too bad, because I was pretty invested in it, actually. And Anthony Michael Hall, here's what I'll say. I think Anthony Michael Hall plays a better Johnny in Stephen King's vision, and I think Christopher Walken plays a good Johnny in David Cronenberg's vision. I was not expecting to really like Anthony Michael Hall in this role, but he brings it. But yeah, watch those first couple episodes, people, if you want to get this movie rehashed, and leave it at that.
Well, especially because The Dead Zone describes a good chunk of his career after he stopped John Hughes movies.
All right, next week, we get to a really hot property, so hot that Drew Barrymore was starting fires in it. We are going to talk about Firestarter. Matt, what are you expecting when we get to Firestarter next week?
Two words, racial insensitivity. That's the only thing, that's the only thing I remember about this original movie. It's casting George C. Scott to play a Native American.
I cannot believe we are saying that out loud. Adam, when we started this retrospective, you had actually mentioned that this movie was getting a lot of play in your house. Is that what you still remember?
Remember it getting played. I can't say I remember it. Yeah. I remember it getting played. I remember Drew Barrymore, and I remember the cover box, because I think it was one of those that, you know, we kind of kept it from the video store for a very, very long time. That's about it. I couldn't remember much of it other than the clips that you see on TV every time they show Drew doing something, and that's about it.
All right, that's next week, and keep coming back. We are going to continue through King. We're going to go through the Running Man portion of his adaptations, and then we'll carry on in the years to come. But I would like to thank my co-host for joining me on this King journey. I know it's had some rough patches, but when we get to a movie like The Dead Zone, a movie that just surprised me with how much I did like it, and coming back to it, it feels worth it to me. And it means a lot that I am able to do this going through one of my writing heroes. So thank you guys for joining me. Until next week, when we get to Firestarter. They call it a coma diet. Lose weight while you podcast. Thank you, boys.
I don't know whether it's true or not, John, about these psychic powers of yours. But I will say this. If God has seen fit to bless you with this gift, you should use it.
Bless me? You know what God did for me? He threw an 18-wheel truck at me. Bounced me into nowhere for 5 years. When I woke up, my girl was gone. My job was gone. My legs are just about useless. Bless me. God's been a real sport to me.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Pretty good stuff, huh?
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice. And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Are you all right?
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
We have to stay in touch.
Please visit and check out our Percolated Media Facebook page to get an advance look at what the boys will be reviewing that week, as well as other things such as Matt and Garrett's wrestling podcast, what the site has in store for the future, some periodically done written reviews, and so much more. Message us, give us your thoughts, visit and share. We greatly appreciate interacting with you, our listeners.
You want to see something? It's the goddamnest thing.
Check out the Percolated Media archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including the Planet of the Apes franchise, the Mad Max movies, the Exorcist films, the movies of the Alien franchise, Jurassic Park, and so many more.
Now listen, Roger, we got a good thing going and it's going strong and I want you to be a part of it. I need your support. I need your expertise. I need your input. And most importantly, I need your money.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Why I have to stay locked up here in the house. I'm already living in a controlled environment, Sam.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
I brought you a visitor.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Don't you know who I am?
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
They all want the same thing. Reassurance, help, love. Things I can't give them.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
It's not too late.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
When it happens, when the spells come, it feels like
I don't know. It feels like I'm dying inside.
I'll be seeing you.
Thanks for dropping by, Greg.
Not at all. I'll see you. Bye-bye.
Good to see you, Sonny.
Now, we have discussed that up to now, we had Carrie, we had The Shining, we had the Stand, and of course, Night Shift. The Dead Zone was his first... What's that?
You forgot Salem's Lot.
Oh, yeah. We had Salem's Lot. So Johnny walks into the hospital room that his mom was in, and then... I already said that. So he grabs his mom's hand. When Johnny says it was Da, he saw... Excuse me. When Johnny says it was Dodd that he saw, I actually did not remember him being as lovably campy as he is here.
As much as it seems like it's over the...
Go ahead.
He almost plays the same character 10 years down the road in Spawn.
Oh my god. Except far toned down because he looks like he's about to fall asleep before every take. And you can tell he sort of has the Tommy Lee Jones thing where he has this look of, I would rather be anywhere else than dealing with John Leguizamo's bullshit right now.
I saw that in theaters and I don't remember anything of it.
We'll work it in.
We